Chapter 11. Rodarid, the old capital of Avon province, was a pointed city, a forest of pines, and above the spires of the pines, an airier forest of towers. The streets were dark and narrow, mossy, often misty, under the trees. Only from the seven bridges across the river could one look up and see the tops of the towers. Some of them were hundreds of feet tall. Others were mere shoots, like ordinary houses gone to seed. Some were of stone, others of porcelain, mosaic, sheets of colored glass, sheathings of copper, tin, or gold. Ornate, beyond belief, delicate, glittering. In these hallucinatory and charming streets, the Araste Council of World Governments had had its seat for the 300 years of its existence. Many embassies and consulates to the CWG and to IAO also clustered in Rodarid, only an hour's ride from Neo-Essaya and the national seat of government. The Terran embassy to the CWG was housed in the River Castle, which crouched between the Neo Highway and the river, sending up only one squat, grudging tower with a square roof and lateral window slits like narrowed eyes. Its walls had withstood weapons and weathers for 1,400 years. Dark trees clustered near its landward side, and between them a drawbridge lay across a moat. The drawbridge was down, and its gates stood open. The moat, the river, the green grass, the black walls, the flag on top of the tower, all glimmered mistily as the sun broke through a river fog, and the bells in all the towers of Rodarid began their prolonged and insanely harmonious task of ringing 7 o'clock. A clerk at the very modern reception desk inside the castle was occupied with a tremendous yawn. "We aren't really open till 8 o'clock," he said hollowly. "I want to see the ambassador." "The ambassador is at breakfast. You'll have to make an appointment." In saying this, the clerk wiped his watery eyes and was able to see the visitor clearly for the first time. He stared, moved his jaw several times, and said, "Who are you? Where? What do you want?" "I want to see the ambassador." "You just hold on," the clerk said in the purest Niyati accent, still staring, and put out his hand to a telephone. A car had just drawn up between the drawbridge gate and the entrance of the embassy, and several men were getting out of it, the metal fittings of their black coats glittering in the sunlight. Two other men had just entered the lobby from the main part of the building, talking together, strange-looking people, strangely clothed. Shevik hurried around the reception desk towards them, trying to run. "Help me," he said. They looked up, startled. One drew back, frowning. The other one looked past Shevik at the uniformed group who were just entering the embassy. "Right in here," he said with coolness, took Shevik's arm and shut himself and Shevik into a little side office, with two steps and a gesture, as neat as a ballet dancer. "What's up? You're from Neo-Essaya? I want to see the ambassador." "Are you one of the strikers?" "Shevik, my name is Shevik, from Anaris." The alien eyes flashed, brilliant, intelligent, in the jet-black face. "My God," the Terran said under his breath, and then idiotic. "Are you asking asylum?" "I don't know. I..." "Come with me, Dr. Shevik. I'll get you somewhere you can sit down." There were halls, stairs, the black man's hand on his arm. People were trying to take his coat off. He struggled against them, afraid they were after the notebook in his shirt pocket. Somebody spoke authoritatively in a foreign language. Somebody else said to him, "It's all right. He's trying to find out if you're hurt. Your coat's bloody." "Another man," Shevik said. "Another man's blood." He managed to sit up, though his head swam. He was on a couch in a large, sunlit room. Apparently, he had fainted. A couple of men and women stood near him. He looked at them without understanding. "You are in the embassy of Terra, Dr. Shevik. You are on Terran soil here. You are perfectly safe. You can stay here as long as you want." The woman's skin was yellow-brown, like ferrous earth, and hairless, except on the scalp, not shaven, but hairless. The features were strange and childlike, small mouth, low-bridged nose, eyes with long full lids, cheeks and chin rounded, fat-padded. The whole figure was rounded, supple, childlike. "You are safe here," she repeated. He tried to speak, but could not. One of the men pushed him gently on the chest, saying, "Lie down, lie down." He lay back, but he whispered, "I want to see the ambassador." "I'm the ambassador. Kang is my name. We are glad you came to us. You are safe here. Please, rest now, Dr. Shevik, and we'll talk later. There is no hurry." Her voice had an odd sing-song quality, but it was husky, like Takver's voice. "Takver," he said in his own language. "I don't know what to do." She said, "Sleep." And he slept. After 2 days' sleep and 2 days' meals, dressed again in his gray Iyadi suit, which they had cleaned and pressed for him, he was shown into the ambassador's private salon on the third floor of the tower. The ambassador neither bowed to him nor shook his hand, but joined her hands palm to palm before her breast and smiled. "I'm glad you feel better, Dr. Shevik." "No, I should say simply, Shevik, should I? Please, sit down. I'm sorry that I have to speak to you in Iyotic, a foreign language to both of us. I don't know your language. I am told that it's a most interesting one, the only rationally invented language that has become the tongue of a great people." He felt big, heavy, hairy beside this suave alien. He sat down in one of the deep, soft chairs. Kang also sat down, but grimaced as she did so. "I have a bad back," she said, "from sitting in these comfortable chairs." And Shevik realized then that she was not a woman of 30 or less, as he had thought, but was 60 or more. Her smooth skin and childish physique had deceived him. "At home," she went on, "we mostly sit on cushions on the floor. But if I did that here, I would have to look up even more at everyone. You Setians are all so tall. We have a little problem. That is, we really do not, but the government of Aiyo does. Your people on Anaris, the ones who maintain radio communication with Urus, you know, have been asking very urgently to speak with you. And the Iyadi government is embarrassed." She smiled, a smile of pure amusement. "They don't know what to say." She was calm. She was calm as a water-worn stone which contemplated calms. Shevik sat back in his chair and took a very considerable time to answer. "Does the Iyadi government know that I'm here?" "Well, not officially. We have said nothing. They have not asked. But we have several Iyadi clerks and secretaries working here in the embassy, so, of course, they know." "Is it a danger to you, my being here?" "Oh, no. Our embassy is to the Council of World Governments, not to the nation of Aiyo. You had a perfect right to come here, which the rest of the council would force Aiyo to admit. And, as I told you, this castle is Terran soil." She smiled again. Her smooth face folded into many little creases and unfolded. A delightful fantasy of diplomats. This castle 11 light years from my Earth. This room in a tower in Rodarid, in Aiyo, on the planet Urus of the sun Tau Ceti, is Terran soil. "Then you can tell them I am here." "Good. It will simplify matters. I wanted your consent." "There was no message for me from Anaris?" "I don't know. I didn't ask. I didn't think of it from your point of view. If you are worried about something, we might broadcast to Anaris. We know the wavelength your people there have been using, of course, but we haven't used it because we were not invited to. It seemed best not to press, but we can easily arrange a conversation for you." "You have a transmitter?" "We would relay through our ship, the Hainish ship that stays in orbit around Urus. Hain and Terra work together, you know. The Hainish ambassador knows you're with us. He is the only person who has been officially informed, so the radio is at your service. He thanked her with the simplicity of one who does not look behind the offer for the offer's motive. She studied him for a moment, her eyes shrewd, direct, and quiet. "I heard your speech," she said. He looked at her as from a distance. "Speech?" "When you spoke at the great demonstration in Capitol Square, a week ago today. We always listen to the clandestine radio, the socialist workers' and the libertarians' broadcasts. Of course, they were reporting the demonstration. I heard you speak. I was very moved. Then there was a noise, a strange noise, and one could hear the crowd beginning to shout. They did not explain. There was screaming. Then it died off the air, suddenly. It was terrible, terrible to listen to. And you were there. How did you escape from that? How did you get out of the city? Old Town is still cordoned off. There are 3 regiments of the army in Neo. They round up strikers and suspects by the dozen and hundred every day. How did you get here?" He smiled faintly. "In a taxi. Through all the checkpoints? And in that blood-stained coat? And everyone knows what you look like." "I was under the back seat. The taxi was commandeered. Is that the word? It was a risk some people took from me." He looked down at his hands, clasped on his lap. He sat perfectly quietly and spoke quietly. But there was an inner tension, a strain, visible in his eyes and in the lines around his mouth. He thought a while, and went on in the same detached way. "It was luck at first. When I came out of hiding, I was lucky not to be arrested at once. But I got into Old Town. After that, it was not just luck. They thought for me where I might go. They planned how to get me there. They took the risks." He said a word in his own language, then translated it. "Solidarity." "It is very strange," said the ambassador from Terra. "I know almost nothing about your world, Shevik. I know only what the Erasti tell us, since your people won't let us come there. I know, of course, that the planet is arid and bleak, and how the colony was founded, that it is an experiment in non-authoritarian communism, that it has survived for 170 years. I have read a little of Odo's writings, not very much. I thought that it was all rather unimportant to matters on Urus now, rather remote, an interesting experiment. But I was wrong, wasn't I? It is important. Perhaps Anaris is the key to Urus. The revolutionists in Neo, they come from that same tradition. They weren't just striking for better wages or protesting the draft. They are not only socialists. They are anarchists. They were striking against power. You see, the size of the demonstration, the intensity of popular feeling, and the government's panic reaction all seemed very hard to understand. Why so much commotion? The government here is not despotic. The rich are very rich indeed, but the poor are not so very poor. They are neither enslaved nor starving. Why aren't they satisfied with bread and speeches? Why are they super sensitive? Now I begin to see why. But what is still inexplicable is that the government of Aio, knowing this libertarian tradition was still alive, and knowing the discontent in the industrial cities, still brought you here, like bringing the match to the powder mill. I was not to be near the powder mill. I was to be kept from the populace, to live among scholars and the rich, not to see the poor, not to see anything ugly. I was to be wrapped up in cotton, in a box, in a wrapping, in a carton, in a plastic film, like everything here. There I was to be happy and do my work, the work I could not do on Anaris. And when it was done, I was to give it to them, so they could threaten you with it. Threaten us? Terra, you mean? And Hain? And the other interspatial powers? Threaten us with what? With the annihilation of space. She was silent a while. Is that what you do? She said in her mild, amused voice. No, it is not what I do. In the first place, I am not an inventor or engineer. I am a theorist. What they want from me is a theory of the general field in temporal physics. Do you know what that is? Shevik, your Sedian physics, your noble science, is completely beyond my grasp. I am not trained in mathematics, in physics, in philosophy, and it seems to consist of all of those, and cosmology, and more besides. But I know what you mean when you say the theory of simultaneity, in the way I know what is meant by the theory of relativity. That is, I know that relativity theory led to certain great practical results, and so I gather that your temporal physics may make new technologies possible. He nodded. What they want, he said, is the instantaneous transferal of matter across space. Transcellience. Space travel, you see, without traversal of space or lapse of time. They may arrive at it yet, not from my equations, I think. But they can make the Ansible with my equations if they want to. Men cannot leap the great gaps, but ideas can. What is an Ansible, Shevik? An idea. He smiled without much humor. It will be a device that will permit communication without any time interval between two points in space. The device will not transmit messages, of course. Simultaneity is identity. But to our perceptions, that simultaneity will function as a transmission, a sending. So we will be able to use it to talk between worlds without the long waiting for the message to go and the reply to return that electromagnetic impulses require. It is really a very simple matter, like a kind of telephone. King laughed. The simplicity of physicists. So I could pick up the Ansible and talk with my son in Delhi and with my granddaughter, who was 5 when I left, and who lived 11 years while I was traveling from Terra to Urus in a nearly light-speed ship, and I could find out what's happening at home now, not 11 years ago. And decisions could be made, and agreements reached, and information shared. I could talk to diplomats on Chifawar. You could talk to physicists on Hain. It wouldn't take ideas a generation to get from world to world. Do you know, Shevik, I think your very simple matter might change the lives of all the billions of people in the 9 known worlds. He nodded. It would make a league of worlds possible, a federation. We have been held apart by the years, the decades, between leaving and arriving, between question and answer. It's as if you had invented human speech. We can talk, at last, we can talk together. And what will you say? His bitterness startled Kang. She looked at him and said nothing. He leaned forward in his chair and rubbed his forehead painfully. Look, he said, I must explain to you why I have come to you and why I came to this world also. I came for the idea, for the sake of the idea. To learn, to teach, to share in the idea. On Anaris, you see, we have cut ourselves off. We don't talk with other people, the rest of humanity. I could not finish my work there, and if I had been able to finish it, they did not want it. They saw no use in it. So I came here. Here is what I need. The talk, the sharing, an experiment in the light laboratory that proves something it wasn't meant to prove. A book of relativity theory from an alien world. The stimulus I need. And so I finish the work at last. It is not written out yet, but I have the equations and the reasoning. It is done. But the ideas in my head aren't the only ones important to me. My society is also an idea. I was made by it. An idea of freedom, of change, of human solidarity, an important idea. And though I was very stupid, I saw at last that by pursuing the one, the physics, I am betraying the other. I am letting the propertarians buy the truth from me. What else could you do, Shevik? Is there no alternative to selling? Is there not such a thing as the gift? Yes. Do you not understand that I want to give this to you, and to Hain, and the other worlds, and to the countries of Urus, but to you all, so that one of you cannot use it, as Aio wants to do, to get power over the others, to get richer, or to win more wars, so that you cannot use the truth for your private profit, but only for the common good. In the end, the truth usually insists upon serving only the common good, Kang said. In the end, yes, but I am not willing to wait for the end. I have one lifetime, and I will not spend it for greed and profiteering and lies. I will not serve any master. Kang's calmness was a much more forced, willed affair than it had been at the beginning of their talk. The strength of Shevik's personality, unchecked by any self-consciousness or consideration of self-defense, was formidable. She was shaken by him, and looked at him with compassion and a certain awe. "What is it like?" she said. "What can it be like, the society that made you? I heard you speak of Anaris in the square, and I wept listening to you. But I didn't really believe you. Men always speak so of their homes, of the absent land, but you are not like other men. There is a difference in you." "The difference of the idea," he said. "It was for the idea that I came here, too, for Anaris. Since my people refused to look outward, I thought I might make others look at us. I thought it would be better not to hold apart behind a wall, but to be a society among the others. A world among the others, giving and taking. But there, I was wrong. I was absolutely wrong." "Why so? Surely because there is nothing. Nothing on Urus that we Anaresti need. We left with empty hands 170 years ago, and we were right. We took nothing. Because there is nothing here but states and their weapons, the rich and their lies, and the poor and their misery. There is no way to act rightly with a clear heart on Urus. There is nothing you can do that profit does not enter into, and fear of loss, and the wish for power. You cannot say good morning without knowing which of you is superior to the other, or trying to prove it. You cannot act like a brother to other people. You must manipulate them, or command them, or obey them, or trick them. You cannot touch another person, yet they will not leave you alone. There is no freedom. It is a box. Urus is a box, a package, with all the beautiful wrapping of blue sky and meadows and forests and great cities. And you open the box, and what is inside it? A black cellar full of dust and a dead man, a man whose hand was shot off because he held it out to others. I have been in hell at last. Desar was right. It is Urus. Hell is Urus. For all his passion, he spoke simply, with a kind of humility, and again the ambassador from Terra watched him with a guarded yet sympathetic wonder, as if she had no idea how to take that simplicity. "We are both aliens here, Shevik," she said at last. "I from much farther away in space and time, yet I begin to think that I am much less alien to Urus than you are. Let me tell you how this world seems to me. To me and to all my fellow Terrans who have seen the planet, Urus is the kindliest, most various, most beautiful of all the inhabited worlds. It is the world that comes as close as any could to paradise." She looked at him calmly and keenly. He said nothing. "I know it's full of evils, full of human injustice, greed, folly, waste. But it is also full of good, of beauty, vitality, achievement. It is what a world should be. It is alive, tremendously alive, alive despite all its evils, with hope. Is that not true? He nodded. Now, you, man from a world I cannot even imagine, you who see my paradise as hell, will you ask what my world must be like? He was silent, watching her, his light eyes steady. My world, my earth, is a ruin, a planet spoiled by the human species. We multiplied and gobbled and fought until there was nothing left, and then we died. We controlled neither appetite nor violence. We did not adapt. We destroyed ourselves, but we destroyed the world first. There are no forests left on my earth. The air is gray. The sky is gray. It is always hot. It is habitable. It is still habitable, but not as this world is. This is a living world, a harmony. Mine is a discord. You Odonians chose a desert. We Terrans made a desert. We survived there as you do. People are tough. There are nearly a half billion of us now. Once, there were 9 billion. You can see the old cities still everywhere. The bones and bricks go to dust. But the little pieces of plastic never do. They never adapt either. We failed as a species, as a social species. We are here now dealing as equals with other human societies on other worlds only because of the charity of the Hainish. They came. They brought us help. They built ships and gave them to us so we could leave our ruined world. They treat us gently, charitably, as the strong man treats the sick one. They are a very strange people, the Hainish, older than any of us. Infinitely generous. They are altruists. They are moved by a guilt we don't even understand, despite all our crimes. They are moved in all they do, I think, by the past, their endless past. Well, we had saved what could be saved and made a kind of life in the ruins on Terra, in the only way it could be done, by total centralization. Total control over the use of every acre of land, every scrap of metal, every ounce of fuel. Total rationing. Birth control, euthanasia, universal conscription into the labor force. The absolute regimentation of each life toward the goal of racial survival. We had achieved that much when the Hainish came. They brought us a little more hope. Not very much. We have outlived it. We can only look at this splendid world, this vital society, this Urus, this paradise, from the outside. We are capable only of admiring it, and maybe envying it a little, not very much. Then Inaris, as you heard me speak of it, what would Inaris mean to you, Kang? Nothing. Nothing, Shevik. We forfeited our chance for Inaris centuries ago, before it ever came into being. Shevik got up and went over to the window, one of the long horizontal window slits of the tower. There was a niche in the wall below it, into which an archer would step up to look down and aim at assailants at the gate. If one did not take that step up, one could see nothing from it but the sun-washed, slightly misty sky. Shevik stood below the window, gazing out, the light filling his eyes. You don't understand what time is, he said. You say the past is gone, the future is not real, there is no change, no hope. You think Inaris is a future that cannot be reached, as your past cannot be changed. So there is nothing but the present, this Urus, the rich, real, stable present, the moment now. And you think that is something which can be possessed. You envy it a little. You think it's something you would like to have. But it is not real, you know. It is not stable, not solid. Nothing is. Things change, change. You cannot have anything. And least of all can you have the present, unless you accept with it the past and the future. Not only the past, but also the future, not only the future, but also the past, because they are real. Only their reality makes the present real. You will not achieve or even understand Urus unless you accept the reality, the enduring reality of Anaris. You are right. We are the key. But when you said that, you did not really believe it. You don't believe in Anaris. You don't believe in me, though I stand with you in this room, in this moment. My people were right, and I was wrong in this. We cannot come to you. You will not let us. You do not believe in change, in chance, in evolution. You would destroy us rather than admit our reality, rather than admit that there is hope. We cannot come to you. We can only wait for you to come to us. King sat with a startled and thoughtful, and perhaps slightly dazed expression. I don't understand. I don't understand, she said at last. You are like somebody from our own past, the old idealists, the visionaries of freedom, and yet I don't understand you. As if you were trying to tell me of future things, and yet, as you say, you are here now. She had not lost her shrewdness. She said after a little while, Then why is it that you came to me, Shevik? Oh, to give you the idea. My theory, you know. To save it from becoming a property of the Iadi, an investment or a weapon. If you are willing, the simplest thing to do would be to broadcast the equations, to give them to physicists all over this world, and to the Hainish, and the other worlds, as soon as possible. Would you be willing to do that? More than willing. It will come to only a few pages. The proofs and some of the implications would take longer, but that can come later, and other people can work on them if I cannot. But what will you do then? Do you mean to go back to Neo? The city is quiet now, apparently. The insurrection seems to be defeated, at least for the time being. But I'm afraid the Iadi government regards you as an insurrectionary. There is Thu, of course. No, I don't want to stay here. I am no altruist. If you would help me in this too, I might go home. Perhaps the Iadi would be willing to send me home even. It would be consistent, I think, to make me disappear, to deny my existence. Of course, they might find it easier to do by killing me, or putting me in jail for life. I don't want to die yet, and I don't want to die here in hell at all. Where does your soul go when you die in hell? He laughed. He had regained all his gentleness of manner. But if you could send me home, I think they would be relieved. Dead anarchists make martyrs, you know, and keep living for centuries, but absent ones can be forgotten. I thought I knew what realism was, Kang said. She smiled, but it was not an easy smile. How can you, if you don't know what hope is? Don't judge us too hardly, Shevik. I don't judge you at all. I only ask your help, for which I have nothing to give in return. Nothing? You call your theory nothing? Weigh it in the balance with the freedom of one single human spirit, he said, turning to her. And which will weigh heavier? Can you tell? I cannot.